with a steady, barely contained smile. It is the most difficult baptism of my life, for as I pour water over George's head, Father, Son, Spirit, I know I will walk George outside alone after and tell him what happened. As I do, and I put my arm around him, I whisper gently as we walk out onto the baseball field, George, your brother Cisco was killed last night. I can feel all the air leave his body as he heaves a sigh that finds itself a sob in an instant. We land on a bench. His face seeks refuge in his open palms, and he sobs quietly. Most notable is what isn't present in his rocking and gentle wailing. I've been in this place before many times. There's always flailing and rage and promises to avenge things. There is none of this in George. It is as if the commitment he has just made in water, oil, and flame has taken hold, and his grief is pure and true and more resembles the heartbreak of God. George seems to offer proof of the efficacy of this thing we call sacrament, and he manages to hold all the complexity of this great sadness right here on this bench in his tender weeping. I had previously asked him in the baptismal rite, after outlining the contours of faith and the commitment, to live as though this truth was true. Do you clearly understand what you're doing? And he pauses, and he revs himself up in a gathering of self and soul and says, yes, I do. And yes, he does. In the monastic tradition, the highest form of sanctity is to live in hell and not lose hope. George clings to his hope and his faith and his GED certificate and chooses to march resilient into his future. What is the delivery system for resilience? In part, it's the loving, caring adult who pays attention. It's the community of unconditional love, representing the very no-matter-whatness of God. They say that an educated inmate will not reoffend. This is not because an education assures that this guy will get hired somewhere. It is because his view is larger and more educated, so that he can be rejected at 93 job interviews and still not give up. He's acquired resilience. Sometimes resilience arrives in the moment you discover your own unshakable goodness. Poet Galway Kinnell writes, sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. And when that happens, we begin to foster tenderness for our own human predicament. A spacious and undefended heart finds room for everything you are and carves space for everybody else. I had a 23-year-old homie named Miguel working for me on our graffiti crew. As with a great many of our workers, I had met him years earlier while he was detained. He was an extremely nice kid whose pleasantness was made all the more remarkable by the fact that he had been completely abandoned by his family. Prior to their rejection of him, they had mistreated, abused, and scarred him plenty. He calls me one New Year's Day. Happy New Year, G. Hey, that's very thoughtful of you, dog, I say. You know, Miguel, I was thinking of you, you know, on Christmas. So what you do for Christmas? I asked, knowing that he had no family to welcome him in. Oh, you know, I was just right here, meaning his tiny little apartment where he lives alone. All by yourself, I ask. Oh, no, he quickly says. I invited homies from the crew, you know, vatos like me who didn't have no place to go for Christmas. He names the five homies who came over, all former enemies from rival gangs. Really? I tell him. That sure was nice of you. but he's got me revved and curious now. So, I ask him, what did you do? Well, he says, you're not going to believe this, but I cooked a turkey. You can feel his pride right through the phone. Wow, you did? Well, how'd you prepare it? You know, he says, ghetto style. I tell him that I'm not really familiar with this recipe. He's more than happy to give up his secret. Yeah, well, you just rub it with a gang of butter, throw a bunch of salt and pepper on it, squeeze a couple limones over it, and put it in the oven. It tasted proper. I said, wow, that's impressive. What else did you have besides the turkey? Just that. Just turkey, he says. His voice tapers to a hush. Yeah. The six of us. We just sat there, staring at the oven, waiting for the turkey to be done. One would be hard-pressed to imagine something more sacred and ordinary than these six orphans staring at an oven together. It is the entire law and the prophets, all in one moment, right there, in this humble, holy kitchen. Not long after this, I give Miguel a ride home after work. I had long been curious about Miguel's own certain resilience. When we arrive at his apartment, I say, can I ask you a question? How do you do it? I mean, given all that you've been through, all the pain and stuff you've suffered, how are you like the way you are? I genuinely want to know. And Miguel has his answer at the ready. You know, I always suspected that there was something of goodness in me, but I just couldn't find it. Until one day, he quiets a bit, one day I discovered it here, in my heart. I found it. Goodness. And ever since that day, I have always known who I was. He pauses, caught short by his own truth, reteaching loveliness, and turns and looks at me. And now, nothing can touch me. The poet writes, someone fills the cup in front of us. We taste only sacredness. And the world will throw at us what it will, and we cling to our own sacredness, and nothing can touch us. But as I mentioned earlier, there is a lethal absence of hope in the gang member. There is a failure to conjure up the necessary image that can catapult you into your future. In fact, gang members form an exclusive club of young people who plan their funerals and not their futures. In the late 80s, we had a dance at the parish hall for young folks. Soon, the intensity of gang strife would make such dances a thing of the past. A 16-year-old homegirl named Terry, a natural beauty and the object of every homie's longing, was dressed in this magnificent, short, bright red dress. She greets me at the door, where I provide security. She's radiant. And the toughness often on display in the streets has been left at home. I tell her how gorgeous she looks. Promise me something, G, she says, giddy and enlivened by all the compliments she's getting. Promise me that I get buried in this dress. I'm instantly imagining the ridiculous snapshot of an old woman at repose in her coffin in a dress like this. But Terry envisions no such old woman. An equally young homegirl bounds into my office one day to tell me she's pregnant. I suppose my face telegraphed a little too clearly a decided downsizing of my heart. Before I can say whatever I was going to say, she holds out her hand as if to impede the words. I just want to have a kid before I die. I'm thinking, how does a 16-year-old get off thinking that she won't see 18? It is one of the explanations for teen pregnancies in the barrio. If you don't believe you will reach 18, then you accelerate the whole process, and you become a mother well before you're ready. In my earliest days, when gang violence had me burying more young people than old folks, I would often isolate the kid who had just viewed his dead homeboy in the casket. Maybe he's off by himself, crying and avoiding his camaradas. I figured perhaps I can speak a word to jostle him from his entrenched vow to seek revenge. Perhaps this is the vulnerable moment a window cracked open to me. I would almost always say something like, "I never want to see you lying in a coffin at 16, or whatever his age is." When I first did this, I always expected the same response. "Yeah, that makes two of us. I don't want to die." What was initially startling grew predictable as I buried more kids. For this vulnerable one would always say the same thing with little variation. "Why not? You gotta die sometime." This is the language of the despondent, for whom hope and one's own sacredness are entirely foreign. I remain always curious about the presence or lack thereof of the fathers in the lives of the homies. In the soul of nearly every homie I know, there is a hole that's in the shape of his dad. Homeboy Industries is always trying to create the moment of what psychologists call the sustenance of that first attachment. It is an offering, better late than never, of that parent-child bond that tells the fatherless that they're lovable. The Japanese speak of a concept called amai, living in a deep sense of being cherished, of raising kids lovingly. I had asked one of my workers, David, about his father. David was not long released from camp, still on probation, and was cleaning the office after school as one of our part-timers. "Oh," he says, monotone in place, accustomed as he was to answering this question, "he walked out on us." Then he shakes up the dial tone of his voice and wants to go deeper, truer than he has before. "In fact, the day he chose to walk out on us was my 6th birthday." There is a death behind his eyes that he can't mask. "We had a cake, y todo, but I wouldn't let them cut it. I waited for my jefito to come home. I waited and waited. Nighttime came. He never did." He pauses here for what I presume will be the moment for him to cry, but there is only dryness and a rage you can measure, the needle bouncing to its farthest edge. "I cried till I was 9. I wait for some emotional creaking here, nothing. "I don't cry anymore. I just hate him." The encounter with the father wound is every homeboy's homework. "When I was 10 years old, I walked in on my dad and he had a needle in his arm, all dazed. He looked at me and said, 'Take a good look. This will be you one day.' Another says, 'My dad would fuck us up. I mean, fuck us up. You know, if we didn't massage his feet right or bring his wallet fast enough.' I decided one day, I don't want to become him." Still another, "I wish I never knew his name. Wish I had never seen his face." There is a wound that needs excavating before that first attachment can attach itself elsewhere. Natalie came to work in our organization after keeping up a fairly regular correspondence with me over her years of incarceration. Through placement, juvenile hall, probation camp, and jail, she always let me know where she was, and I had never seen her on the outs until she finally walked through my door. Natalie was a runaway, a gang member, a regular drug user, and had 2 kids who had never been raised by her. Once, while a group of us were approaching Pepperdine University, Natalie pointed down toward the beach and started to get excited. "Ooh, down there. I was in a summer camp there. Yeah, it was a camp for bad kids." Her parents were in and out, but mainly out of her life, since they all had arrived from Cuba.
Yeah, we came on the Mario boat lift. You know, when Castro sent all the bad people here.
Her time working at our place has been pocked by moments of incarceration, suspensions for getting high, even a handful of terminations for fighting. There was also a moment when I asked her not to come into the office. She would pick too many beefs with people. It was easier to get a call and then meet her at Jim's Burgers across the street. She was a handful, to say the very least. She was one of the countless what-if kids. What if she had actually been parented? What if she was surrounded by love and as much attention as a kid needs? What if she just had a stable place to rest her head? I was on the road somewhere in another time zone giving a talk, and I had this vivid dream about Natalie. In some hotel lobby before giving a keynote address, I knew I had to locate her before it was my time to go on. I catch her on her cell. Hey, kiddo, I had a dream about you last night. Oh, no, dread filling her voice. Is it bad? All homies think dreams are omens and predictors of bad things to come. No, no, I assure her. It was a firme dream. I tell her that in the dream I am in this small club, not unlike a tiny comedy club with small tables and a stage with a microphone. The MC approaches the mic and quiets the crowd. Ladies and gentlemen, to sing for you this evening, Ms. Natalie Oritia. The boos are spontaneous and full. The crowd turns on me for some reason. What the hell's going on? They ask me. You know she can't sing worth shit. Stop her. I shrug and say nothing. I remember feeling nervous for her, but I don't intervene. The spotlight follows a gorgeous Natalie as she makes her way to the microphone. She is petite and fair-skinned. She's in a dazzling, bejeweled dress, long and slinky. There seems to be no confidence in her at all, and the crowd all but throws things at her, howling and derisive. The music begins. And you start to sing, kiddo, and it's the most beautiful thing you ever heard in your life. It straight out shuts every damn buddy up. The crowd is silent, and our mouths are open, and none of us can believe this is you singing. But it's stunning. Takes your breath away. I stop talking, and she's silent. And then I woke up. There is such a hush, you would have thought she had left me long ago. You're crying, aren't you?
Of course,
she squeaks. And the soul quickens at hearing what it didn't know it already knew. Kathleen Norris writes, if holding your ground is what you are called to most days, it helps to know your ground. Resilience is born by grounding yourself in your own loveliness, hitting notes you thought were way out of your range. Gangs are bastions of conditional love. One false move and you find yourself outside. Slights are remembered. Errors in judgment held against you forever. If a homie doesn't step up to the plate, perform the required duty, he can be relegated to no good status. This is a state from which it is hard to recover. Homeboy Industries seeks to be a community of unconditional love. Community will always trump gang any day. Derek Walcott writes, either I am a nobody, or I am a nation. Our place at Homeboy is this touchstone of resilience. You discover your true self in this nation. Homies who used to work at Homeboy always return on their days off or on their lunch break. A homie said to me once, I just came by to get my fix. Of what? I ask him. Love, he says. Everyone is just looking to be told that who he or she is right and true and wholly acceptable. No need to tinker and tweak. Exactly right.
I'm working at my desk one day, eyes poring over something. You know how you can feel when two eyeballs are staring at you? I look up and it's Danny. He's a short, chubby 10-year-old who lives in the projects and is one of the fixtures around the office. A goofy, likable kid who does not do well in school. He seems to have purloined this oversized sketch pad nearly as large as he is. He has it resting on his arched knee, and in his right hand is a pencil. He's sketching me. He works furiously on this drawing and then positions his pencil held up at me as if to size up the subject of his portrait. This is a technique he has retrieved, no doubt, from cartoons. He works on the portrait and then stops and holds his thumb and pencil at me to, again, capture my essence. This cracks me up. It is completely charming and funny, so I laugh. Danny gets quite annoyed. "Don't move," he says, with not a little bit of menace. Well, this makes me laugh all the more to think it makes any damn difference if I move. I'm howling a lot now. Danny turns steely on me, not the least bit amused. He becomes a clenched tooth Clint Eastwood. "I said, don't move." I freeze. I stop laughing, and he finishes his portrait. Danny rips the sheet and lays the thing on my desk, revealing his obra de arte. And there, in the middle of this huge piece of paper, about the size of a grapefruit, is me, I guess. Apparently, I've been beat down with the proverbial ugly stick. It is Picasso on his worst day. My glasses are crooked, my eyes not at all where they should be. My face is generally whoppy-jawed, and it is an unrecognizable mess. I'm kind of speechless. Wow, Danny, this is me? Yep, he says, standing proudly in front of my desk, awaiting a fuller verdict. Wow, I hardly know what to say. I mean, it's, very interesting. Danny looks a little miffed. Well, what you expect? You moved. We squirm in the face of our sacredness. And a true community screams a collective, "Don't move." The admonition not to move is nothing less than God's own satisfaction at the sacredness, the loveliness that's there in each one, despite what seems to be a shape that's less than perfect. Though he'd run away from home at 13, I only met Andres at 19, after he had overstayed his welcome in various houses around town. Running away had seemed like the only reasonable thing to do. His mom, seeing in Andres the picture of his father, the man who had walked out on her, funneled all her rage and disdain right at this kid. He became this male Cinderella, slavishly mopping the floors and bathroom of the bar she owned and the small apartment they shared. She didn't exactly abuse him. She tortured him, putting cigarettes out on him, holding his head in the toilet until he nearly drowned. Andres was removed many times from the home by child protectors and just as routinely returned to her care. Once he ran away, he aligned his misery with likely camaradas in a local gang, all hanging on for dear life and sharing the tight confines of their orphan island. When I met him, he was feeling the pressure to move out of the homies pad. We had a shelter for women and children at the time, Casa Miguel Pro, nestled atop the elementary school in what was Dolores Mission Convent. We had an extra room, and I gave it to Andres. Before long, he was employed. Someone had donated a tore-up Ramfla, so he had wheels for work, and generally began to thrive. Andres was one of those interviewed by Mike Wallace. Since I was to do tertianship, a year-long break of reflection, prayer, long retreat, and ministry, required of all Jesuits before they take final vows, and leave for a time
after my tour as pastor. Mike asks Andres, now 21,
"You know, Father Greg says you're a success story, and he's leaving. Are you going to continue on this path of success after Father Greg leaves?"
Before Andres can address the question, Wallace inexplicably hunkers closer to Andres, seeking some inside track camaraderie he frankly hasn't earned, and says,
"You know, you'd really have to be an asshole not to continue on this path of success."
Andres perks like a lion who hears someone coming. "What you call me?" Mike shifts in his middle folding chair like someone had just turned its heating element to high.
Well, this is just a figure of speech. I mean, I'm not calling you that. It's just, well, one would have to be an asshole."
Andres is trembling at this point, his linebacker body wanting to go in 8 directions at once.
"There is only one person who can call me that, and that's Father Greg. Not my family, not even my homies, but certainly not some rich white boy like you."
Andres rips the microphone off his shirt and pounds his way to the side exit of the church where the interview was taking place. Mike's nervous aides pounce on my office. "Andres is mad." When I locate him, he won't let his ire be tamed.
"I was gonna toss him up, G. I was gonna straight out toss him up."
Let's face it, who among us hasn't wanted to toss up Mike Wallace? Andres was alive, vibrant, and thriving as never before, and for the first time ever, there was a lightness to his being. He was proud of himself. One day we bump into each other in the church parking lot.
"You know, I'm thinking of calling my jefita."
"You sure?" I caution. After all, it had been more than 5 years since he had spoken with her.
"Well, yeah," he says. "I mean, she is the only mom I got."
I beam my guest him toward my office, and I leave him. Not 5 minutes later, Andres is standing by my side again, looking stricken. This is what the woman who brought Andres into the world chose to say to her son after not having spoken with or seen him for more than 5 years. This, and only this:
"Tú eres basura."
You are garbage.
Now I'm stricken, barely able to hollow out a place in my own heart for such a thing as this.
Andres's eyes glisten in the midday sun.
"You didn't believe her, did you?"
"Nah.
I forgave her."
Years and years later, Andres plops in one of the chairs in my office, car in the shop. He'd been through many vehicles since that first bucket, and he's bussing it. He wanted to stop by and kick it before taking the bus home to his simple apartment. I offer to drive him home to Montebello.
"Would you mind, G, if we can swing by Ralph's so I can get some stuff? I mean, since I got a ride and all."
We pull into Ralph's, and I watch, always several steps behind, as Andres grabs a shopping cart and commandeers it down aisles of produce and canned goods. When I catch up with him, he says, "Tuesdays are the sales. That's the day to shop." I'm astonished at his assurance and utter familiarity with this place. He knows where to go. He knows what to get. He turns. I'm out of breath keeping up. He's in a confiding mood.
"You know, you gotta be very careful in these big supermarkets."
"You do?" I say, leaning in to catch his drift.
"Oh, hell yeah."
Andres sizes up the aisle to see if there are spies.
"It's that elevator music they be playing,"
he's whispering and pointing above.
"It confuses you. You buy shit you don't need."
Home sweet home in his own skin. A man who has decided to walk in his own footsteps. God eternally satisfied with all his sacredness. Andres, a temple on high,
a holy of holies, right there on aisle 5. Don't move. I was praising a homie for one thing or another on the phone, and he just wouldn't have it. "You know," he insists, "I still have my blemishes." We still have to put our Western minds in a headlock and wrestle them to the ground. We think blemishes are shortcomings. We think our continually gnarly, hardwired responses are not just proof of our humanity, but somehow of our unworthiness. Homies are particularly culpable here. In an acute gangster version of the Stockholm Syndrome, homies identify with and grow attached to their weaknesses and difficulties and burdens. You hope, in the light of this, to shift their attention and allegiance to their own basic goodness. You show them the bright blue sky of their sacredness, and they are transfixed only by the ominous clouds. You stand there with them and encourage them to stare above and wait 20 minutes. "You are the sky," as Pema Chodron would insist. "Everything else is just weather." It would not be uncommon to ask Fabian how he's doing and then hear him respond, "I'm feeling zestfully clean, thank you." It may go without saying that I have never encountered a homie quite like Fabian. Few homeboys are able to incorporate in conversation "pip pip cheerio" or belittle your obvious response to something with "elementary, my dear Watson." Fabian, now in his late 20s and married with 3 kids, worked for years at Homeboy Industries. Now he has a well-paying job and is as decent a human being as I know. He's just so uniquely a person like no other. He can, from memory, do the entire shrimp montage from Forrest Gump. He has also memorized every story from my talks. Once I called him from Palm Springs, seconds before I was to go on, and I was stumped. I couldn't remember the exact wording on something. He didn't even have to think about it. He handed the phrasing right to me. His childhood was a dense mix of gangster father, mentally ill mother, and no one ever really in their cinco sentidos, always high, all the time. When he was 10 or so, his mother was beating him with her high heel when he sought refuge in the closet. She commenced to beat on Fabian's brother Michael, and when his brother's screaming stopped, he peeked out of the closet and saw that his mother had wrapped a wire hanger around his neck, and he was turning blue. Fabian flew to her and body slammed and wrestled her to the ground. Consequently, no one would have been surprised if Fabian had taken up permanent residence in some state-run lockdown facility. But somehow, by a mysterious and gracious turn of some steering wheel, Fabian found other coordinates and navigated his way out of the treacherous waters where others perished. His brand of humor is so smart and odd that one occasionally suspects that some alien has taken possession of this homeboy. Traveling to D.C. to speak in front of a congressional subcommittee, Fabian and Felipe, an enemy from his gang's worst rival, were kicking it upstairs at my brother Paul's house, watching Gremlins. Paul and his wife Joy and I were sipping beers after a long day. Fabian, 19 at the time, came down the stairs to get sodas for himself and Felipe. He goes directly to the refrigerator, making himself at home, but stops when he sees us. "Can I have a beer?"
"No."
Fabian reaches in to get his Cokes and stops. "It would mean a lot to me."
"Nope."
He digs deeper into the fridge and then pulls himself out of there. "I would cherish this moment." I ask you, who talks like this? Just recently, we were on the phone. He is forever calling and checking in, and the conversations rapidly dissolve into a swirling sink of silliness.
I'm ready to deal with all the people lined up to see me in my office, so I try to extricate myself from Fabian's clutches. Well, I say to him, it will be my great pleasure to hang up on your ass right now. He feigns, why I never, huffiness. Then, well, it will be my great pleasure to be hungin' up by you. Good comeback, I tell him. Fabian was spectacular at building good and enduring friendships with his enemies at Homeboy. His tenderness knew no equal, really. He would visit an enemy undergoing brutal chemotherapy and supply him with videos to distract him from the ordeal. He'd do reconnaissance of the hospital area to make sure that none of his enemies were also visiting at the same time. His enemies wouldn't understand. Once, Fabian was stuck in the back seat of a car filled with his homeboys who were giving him a ride home. Hey, look, one of them screams in the car. That's that fool Froggy. The alarmist in the car is pointing at an enemy walking by himself on First Street. Let's bomb on his ass. The car pulls over, and Fabian works his magic. Kick back, you guys. That's my primo.
Serio? He's your cousin?
Yeah, my tia, son. And the car swerves back into merging traffic. Froggy was an enemy Fabian had come to know from our office. They are not related. I just don't know how Fabian managed it. With more mystery than I can explain away, Fabian locked on to the singularity of the love that melts you. It doesn't melt who you are, but who you are not. Turns out, he wasn't all the abuse he endured. He was something else, astonishing and glorious. For more than two decades, I've been working with gang members, and on occasion it occurs to people to present me with some award or another. I've gotten a number of these over the years, a bronze lion, a crystal cachivache, a plaque or framed acknowledgement. Especially in recent years, with a cancer diagnosis, you start getting lifetime achievement awards, if you know what I mean. I've never kept one of these. I always give them to one of the homies. Usually there's a fancy dinner at some Beverly Hills hotel. They give me a table, and I fill it with half homies and half ladies from the projects. They are dressed in their absolute finery, the women in dresses they wore at their daughter's quinceañeras, the homies in perfectly ironed Ben Davis pants and large, untucked plaid shirts. Gangster standard issue. They become intrigued by the amount of silverware at their place settings. What's this fork for? They invariably ask the waiter for tapatio hot sauce. When the gourmet arugula and pear balsamic vinegar salad arrives, they dive in, and someone weighs in. This shit tastes nasty. Someone always says this. After the event, I drive everyone home, knowing that the last homie I drop off is the one to whom I'll give the award. Once, I gave a magnificent ornate plaque to a homie, and he said, "Wow, this is great. And when you kick rocks, I'll sell it on eBay and make a grip of feria money." When I get to the last house with the last homie, I say, "Hey, dog, you're my hero. Look where you've been and where you are now. So I want you to have this bronze lion." I tell him that I'll come visit it from time to time. I had been invited to receive some award from the education department at Loyola Marymount University. I had a speaking engagement up north at the same time, so I asked if I could send one of my workers to receive it on my behalf, knowing that I would have him keep the award afterward. The LMU people agreed, and I selected Elias to accept my premio. Elias was 18 years old, working at Homeboy Silkscreen, and had traded in his gang past for fatherhood and gainful employment. Given the horror show that was his family, environment, and the number of obstacles on his road along the way, his success was all the more astonishing. "Could you go to this event and accept this award on my behalf?" I ask him. He's taken aback by the honor. "Course I will." "Oh, by the way," I continue, "you gotta give a little acceptance speech." His eyes widen. "What?" I tell him to relax, to write a couple paragraphs, and he'll be fine. I tell him that Kara Gould, one of our senior staff at the time, and among the most skilled at working with homies I've ever seen, will take him to LMU. I hear later that the trip to the awards evening is panic central. Elias wants to leap from the moving car. This is how nervous he is. "Kara, I can't do it. I can't speak in front of these people." Kara tries to calm him down. "Look," she says, "they always say that if you're nervous speaking in front of people, just imagine your entire audience is stark naked." Elias turns on her. "I can't do that. I'd be staring the whole time." Once they get to the auditorium, things move from bad to worse. The place is packed, standing room only. Flop sweat dots Elias's forehead. The MC says, "Accepting the award on behalf of Father Greg Boyle is Elias Montes." The crowd claps warmly as Elias awkwardly makes his way to the podium, bathed in a spotlight. He's trembling as he holds the yellow-lined paper on which he's written his speech. It's not much of a speech, really. There is no poetry, only the unmistakable testimony of this kid standing there, transformed and astonishing. The audience seems to get this on the first bounce. He gets to the end with a big finish. "Because Father Greg and Homeboy Industries believed in me, I decided to believe in myself, and the best way I can think of paying them back is by changing my life. That's exactly what I've decided to do. Thank you." The auditorium erupts in applause. They truly go nuts. They are on their feet, and people are crying and shouting. Folks are locating their Kleenex and will not stop clapping. Elias finds his seat. Kara is standing next to him, crying a great deal, but so is the man on the other side of Elias. The ovation continues, and Elias is quite oblivious to it all. Finally, he leans into Kara, who is still standing and applauding with the others, and whispers, "Damn, they're sure clapping a lot for G." Kara crouches toward him. "Oye, menso, they're not clapping for G. They're clapping for you." Elias straightens, as if connected to a power plant. "Nuh-uh," he says. "Yaha," Kara says. "They're clapping for you." And so, an entire room of total strangers hands Elias back to himself and says in no uncertain terms, "Don't move." Jason's appearance in my office was a first. Though I had known him most of his life, he was an expert at resisting my offers of help. In the interim, Jason had done his share of dirt for his gang. He would rather be employed selling crack than in anything else. He was cemented in his resistance to me, and yet there he was, that day, in my office. "Yes, Milagro. I can't believe you're here," I say. Jason was uncharacteristically quiet, humble in the face of whatever it was that was happening to him. I wish I could flesh out more why and how Jason managed to show up in my office that day. It's all quite mysterious to me. With my ear to the ground, I knew only his total commitment to his barrio and drug dealing and general criminality. I couldn't draw a straight line between the fact of his appearance in my office that day and some pivotal recent moment in the past. I still could only see the goofy kid I had met 15 years earlier, who had no recourse but to let the streets raise him. I send him to one of our job developers, who in turn sends him to a job interview that very day. Not 2 hours later, he's back, brimming with excitement. He stands in the doorway of my office. "I got the job!" "That's great," I say. "Yeah," he says. "The manager said I fit the description." He's got me here. "Well, I suppose," I say, "if you're America's most wanted," he might have said fit the description. "Or did he say you met the qualifications?" Jason convulses, giggles, and slaps his forehead. "Yeah, that one, met the qualification. Jeez, what was I thinking? Fit the description. Stupid." Jason dropped by often after that, to just get his fix, I suppose. Hoping to get an even better job, he'd get help with his resume. More often than not, he'd just check in with me. This seemed easy for him, no longer saddled with the shame of his previous knucklehead existence. He held his head high and could face me. He could gaze at himself in the mirror and not move. It had been a long time, if ever, since he was able to do that. "I finally realized why I was out there so long," he tells me in one of his visits, referring to his gangbanging and drug dealing. "Yeah, I can see why now. It's just, I was so fucking angry all the time." And of course, why wouldn't he be? Both parents were heroin addicts, and he was left to raise himself, which kids are meant not to be good at. "And now," he says, "I just let it all go. The anger, I mean." In one of his drop-bys on a Wednesday, I ask him, "So, are we all set for your daughter's baptism on Saturday?" "Oh, yeah," he says. "I bought the dress yesterday. She's going to look beautiful." The next morning, on the way to a job interview for a better position, Jason was gunned down. Someone drove by and saw him, and perhaps all his past had become present again. I buried him a week later and baptized his daughter at his funeral mass. Water, oil, flame. I landed on the gospel that I wanted to use at his liturgy. Jesus says, "You are the light of the world." I like even more what Jesus doesn't say. He does not say, "One day, if you are more perfect and try really hard, you'll be light." He doesn't say, "If you play by the rules, cross your T's and dot your I's, then maybe you'll become light." No, he says straight out, "You are light." It is the truth of who you are, waiting only for you to discover it. So for God's sake, don't move. No need to contort yourself to be anything other than who you are. Jason was who he was. He made a lot of mistakes. He was not perfect, and his rage called the shots for a goodly chunk of his life. And he was the light of the world. He fit the description. Chapter 5. Slow Work. David had decided to change. 16 years old, back in school for the first time in the longest, and working part-time for me at Homeboy, David liked living in his own skin again, or perhaps for the first time. He enjoyed being as smart as he was discovering himself to be. One day he lands in my office and seems to want to try his hand at small talk. "You know," he says, "I ran into a man who attended one of your talks recently." I give a lot of talks, and David has accompanied me several times. "Really?" I say. "That's nice." "Yep," he says. "He found your talk rather monotonous." "Gosh," I say with some dismay. "Really? He did?" "Well, actually," David says, "that didn't happen, but I just need practice using bigger words." I suggest that he practice on somebody else. In 12-step recovery programs, they often say, "It takes what it takes."
This is true enough when it comes to change. The light bulb appears and it brightens. Who can explain how or when? We can't do this for each other. David just decided. After Mass at Central Juvenile Hall in Los Angeles, I spot a kid named Omar, 17 years old, whom I had known for some years. I actually never knew him on the outs, only in a variety of detention facilities, like the halls or camps or in a placement. He never seemed to be out very long before he'd find himself swept up yet again in gangbanging and life on the streets. He gesticulates wildly at me as he's being led back to his unit. "Come see me," he mouths his unit. "KL!" I locate Omar in the day room of Unit KL. He knows the drill. He quickly sweeps up two plastic chairs, whose backs are carved with gang graffiti, and carries them away from the others, landing near the windows out of earshot. He tells me he'll be leaving on Thursday, and I can't help but think I will be bumping into him yet again in one of these county-controlled facilities. After a half hour, I eye the clock on the wall and tell Omar, "Gotta go, Doc." "Why so fast, G?" he asks. I stand. "I have an anniversary mass at the cemetery for a homie I buried a year ago, so gotta go." Omar stays seated and is uncharacteristically pensive. "Hey, G," he says, "can I ask you a question?" "Sure, Mikkel," I say. "Anything." "How many homies have you buried? You know, killed because of gangbanging?" "75, son." That was some years ago. If you asked today, it would be more than twice that number. "Damn, gee, 75. He shakes his head in disbelief, his voice a bare hush now. "I mean, damn. When's it gonna end?" I reach down to Omar and go to shake his hand. We connect, and I pull him up to his feet. I hold his hand with both of mine and zero in on his eyes. "Mikkel, it will end," I say, "the minute you decide." The moistening of his eyes surprises me. He grabs my hands in his. "Well," he says, "then I decide." "Omar," I tell him, "it has always been as simple as that." "How many things have to happen to you," Robert Frost writes, "before something occurs to you?" Change awaits us. What is decisive is our deciding. Mass is about to begin at Camp Months, and I've been shaking hands with the gathering homies filing into the gym. They're all dressed in their military fatigues, smiling and courteous. There is one kid covered in tattoos, face and arms, which is not usual with this young age group. I pull him out of line, and he says his name is Grumpy. He only offers his gang moniker and seems tougher on the first bounce than most kids are. "Look," I say, fishing one of my cards from my pocket, "call me when you get out, and we'll remove your tattoos for free." Now, usually, when I say this, the response is nearly always the same. They grab the card and stare at it and say something like, "Really? Wow! For free? Firme!" But not Grumpy. He doesn't take my card. He looks at me, as the homies would say, all crazy, and on total loud status says, "Yeah, well, why'd they get 'em if I'm just gonna take 'em off?" He's huffy and belligerent. This almost never happens. In the face of this rare occurrence, I become quite placid and find my preternatural calm voice. "Well," I say, "I don't even know you, but I know why you got all these tattoos." "Yeah?" Louder still, he says. "Then why'd I get them?" "Well, simple," I say, as quiet as he is loud. "One day, when you weren't looking, your head got stuck up your butt." "That's right, dog. You straight out keistered your cabeza. So," and I force my card into his hand, "you call me the minute you locate your head." Not my proudest moment. But as the homies might say, I don't let myself. Which is to say, you get crazy with me, I tend to get crazy back. I'm working on it. Some 5 months later, someone gives me a slew of Lakers tickets, enough to fill the parish van with the Pandilla Mugrosa, a group of troublemaking little ones from Pico Gardens, who all seem to have a common allegiance to bad hygiene and allergy to bathing. It was when the Lakers still played in the Forum, and we had been blessed with seats not in the nosebleed section, but in the cerebral hemorrhage section. The gaggle of project kids was running up ahead of me, but I took my time climbing the stairs. Suddenly, in about 15 of the aisle seats, a group of Camp Munt's youth all stand to salute me. "Hey, G," one says, "it's us from Camp Munt's." They come into focus for me. They are all in their camouflage garb, given free tickets as well. I shake the hands of each one, seated all behind one another on the aisle. The hollering, "down in front," does not make us speed up our greeting. We're all mutually excited to have bumped into one another. I'm nearing the end, and the third to the last vato is grumpy. We fix on each other. I extend my hand to his. He refuses to shake it. I think, not good. There is a beat before, quite unexpectedly, Grumpy throws his arms around me and squeezes tight. He leans into my ear and whispers, "I get out Tuesday. I'll call you Wednesday. I want you to take my tattoos off." Teilhard de Chardin wrote that we must trust in the slow work of God. Ours is a God who waits. Who are we not to? It takes what it takes for the great turnaround. Wait for it. In the early days, I was not always so good at waiting. I would find myself on my bike in the housing projects, coaxing and nudging homies to embrace the employment opportunities that would sometimes come my way. Leo was a case in point. More times than I can remember, I'd set something up. "Okay, Doc, I got an interview for you," I'd tell Leo, a 19-year-old dropout, who'd pass most of his day just kicking it with his homies in the projects. Leo was a short, squat, exceedingly likable kid you could not resist wanting to help. Often I would set something up, an interview, a chance of a chance of something, and his enthusiasm never waned. "Yeah, firme," he'd say. And when the designated moment arrived, Leo would leave me hanging in the designated spot. I'd wait, and he'd never show up. This happened to me more than a handful of times. One evening, late, I'm standing with some homies in the darkness of one of the project archways. At some distance in the nearby parking lot, I can see Leo running up to a car and making a sale. He's counting his money and walks toward our poorly lit archway. When he arrives, he looks up and is mortified to see me, to know that I've witnessed this entire transaction. The expression he's sporting is cara de cachado. "Spensa, G," he says. "La neta, I didn't even see you there. My bad." "No need to apologize, Mikko," I say to him. "You taught me something tonight." "I did?" Leo says, confused, yet obviously interested. "That's right," I say. "Tonight you taught me that no amount of my wanting you to have a life is the same as you wanting to have one. Now I can help you get a life. I just can't give you the desire to want one. So, when you want a life, call me." And I walk away more than a little discouraged. I contemplate a career change, crossing guard, perhaps. Some months later, Leo did call me. "It's time already," he says. I knew exactly what that meant. "So, what caused the light bulb to turn on?" I ask. "Well, today, I was watching Jerry Springer." Apparently, people throwing chairs at each other wakes your ass up. Who knew? "And they had a commercial about that ITT Institute where you learn shit, and I think, maybe I'll call G, you know, and get me one of them careers.